Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. Find this everything we record at vnnforum.com, also at alexlinder.com permanently when we get it up there. Today we're going to do one chapter, part three, chapter 10, Washington 1964, of Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control. It's not too long, maybe 14 pages max. Let's dig into it. Part three, chapter 10, Washington, 1964, page 418. In November of 1964, around the time the secret conferences on contraception were being held at Notre Dame, Lyndon Johnson had just been swept by a landslide into the White House, and the nation, as it had been during the Great Awakening and periodically ever since, found itself in the middle of one more moral crusade, this one being known as the Civil Rights Movement. Like abolition, multiculturalism, and the anti-smoking campaign of the 1990s, the Civil Rights Movement received the blessing of the WASP ethnos, and largely through the instrumentality of foundation funding, especially the Ford Foundation, it was prosecuted with their interests in mind. This meant that it would have an inevitable sexual subtext, one that would become painfully apparent when it came to the sexual mores of the black family. So again, 1964... LBJ swept into office in the election after JFK was assassinated. And civil rights is becoming a thing, and it's blessed by WASP ethnos, and they have their own interest in mind, and that's going to mean trying to curtail the black birth rate. The conventional explanation of that movement was somewhat different. By 1964, the end of the Second World War was almost 20 years in the past, and there was a sense in the nation that it had acquired enough material and spiritual capital to move forward toward a solution to one of its most persistent problems, namely the race issue, especially its economic dimensions. 4 years earlier, John F. Kennedy had been elected on a platform which seemed to capitalize in a vague way on this desire to do something. Michael Harrington had written The Other America, which brought attention to the people who had been left behind by the increasing wave of post-war prosperity. The largest and most easily identifiable segment of those left behind was the Negro, and their cause had maintained an increasingly commanding grip on the nation's attention over the previous 10 years. Beginning with Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, decision in 1954, the federal government had increasingly thrown its weight behind the struggle to dismantle the legacy of racial segregation which the South had erected after the Civil War. In 1963, President Kennedy was assassinated in a southern city, and in 1964, Lyndon Johnson, his successor, actualized his legacy, or the legacy of his predecessor, by enacting the Civil Rights Bill that would bear the year's name, that year's name, the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. During the summer of 1964, the civil rights struggle captured the nation's attention in Atlantic City when the Mississippi Freedom Delegation tried to unseat that state's delegates to the Democratic Convention. It was a significant sour note in what was otherwise a love feast celebrating the foregone conclusion that Lyndon Johnson was going to get the party's nomination and the presidency a few months later. If that note of discord seemed out of place in Atlantic City, it was a note that was to be heard with increasing frequency over the next 4 years, as the liberal sense of purpose that captured the nation with the rout of Barry Goldwater and his brand of conservatism turned increasingly sour. In the course of those 4 years, President Johnson would go from a man who was an avid supporter of the black cause to someone bitterly disappointed by it and its leaders, leaders he would come to feel were only interested in political posturing and handouts from the government. The liberal establishment, which in the early 60s included the civil rights movement, was content to destroy its working relationship with the president in the name of opposition to the war, ideological purity, and racial separatism. Black leadership, decimated by the death of Martin Luther King, drifting into ever more self-defeating political posturing and an even more self-defeating espousal of various forms of leftism and violent revolution. During the Johnson administration, a revolution of sorts did take place, but it was cultural in nature and not the political revolution the left expected. The people who began the decade by asking not what their country could do for them, but what they could do for it, ended the decade by calling for the government's overthrow, and when that failed, focused their revolutionary zeal on their own lives, looking for ways to eradicate any traces of the social order there. In late 1964, racial politics and demagoguery were only synonymous in reference to white Southern politicians. Blacks, by adhering to a strategy of nonviolent resistance, were in firm possession of the moral high ground. The civil rights movement was not then perceived as just another group interested in shaking down money from the federal government. It was not then perceived as something solely within the Negro sphere of interest either. It was, rather, seen as the cutting edge of social reform in the country. The dark legacy of the past was finally going to be expunged as the sunlight of interracial cooperation spread across the land. Freedom was a concept taken from the days of slavery and applied not only to the descendants of the slaves, but to those who looked upon this movement as a paradigm of social progress as well. Experience, Ben Franklin had warned, keeps a dear school, but fools will learn in no other. The children of this century of failed utopian experiments, many of which were based on race, showed no inclination to begin anything, toward no inclination to being anything but slow learners in this regard. The grim experiences of 20 to 30 years before were swept away in the euphoria of the moment that was the 60s, and the certitude that the South in this country was backward, an embarrassment, and just plain wrong. Never before in recent memory was the conservatism which dominated American politics in the aftermath of Wilson's failed foreign policy, that is World War I, looked upon with such disfavor. Just what was it that these Southerners wanted to conserve? If it was something other than ill-gotten privileges based on race, that something was not making it into the mainstream of American opinion, which is, i.e., Jewish mass media. Similarly, was it really possible to portray Barry Goldwater as a defender of the common good and social order? Was that possible with George Wallace? No, in 1964, conservatism was synonymous with reaction, and the prime reaction was against the noble Southern Negro and his quest for political equality. That sense of fairness that would be outraged 30 years later by affirmative action was outraged then by the flagrant attempt to deny the Negro his rights. However, the general sense of liberal goodwill vis-a-vis the race issue at this time did little to hide the fact that the civil rights movement had achieved pretty much what it set out to do by 1964, and in terms of strategic initiatives was running on empty. The legal structure of segregation had been dismantled. The civil rights movement had trained its moral forces for a campaign in the South that had been largely won, not without sacrifices, but won nonetheless over a remarkably short period. Now they were suddenly at a loss, or stated less dramatically, they were at the very least at a crossroads. Should they concentrate their efforts on the strategies which had proven tried and true in the past? Should they agitate for the passage of more bills based on protest in the South? Or should they broaden the movement to include the status of the increasingly large numbers of Negroes in the large cities of the North, whose problems seem particularly intractable and related to the fast-disappearing Jim Crow laws of the South in a way that was not immediately apparent? Bayard Rustin, to give just one example, found jobs for 120 teenagers in Harlem after the Harlem riots of 1964. Quote, a few weeks later, this report continues, only 12 of them were still working. One boy told Rustin he could make more money playing pool than the $50 a week he had been earning. Another could make more than his $60 salary by selling pot. Another turned down a 4-year basketball scholarship to a major university because he preferred to be a pimp, quote unquote. Just how did anecdotes of this sort fit in with the image of the noble Negro of the South, who seemed so Christian in his determination to be nonviolent in the face of enormous provocation that he put an entire nation to shame? It was a problem that not only blacks found perplexing. During the fall of 1964, a Catholic undersecretary at the Department of Transportation in the Johnson administration devoted his time to pondering the question of Negro poverty and the connection between that poverty and the family. Daniel Patrick Moynihan had arrived at the White House as part of the previous administration's New Frontier and had stayed on into the Johnson administration after Kennedy's assassination. His original theater of operations was the Department of Labor, and so as part of his study, he began to examine that department's statistics on the correlation between unemployment rates and rates of marital disruption. Late in November 1964, after Lyndon Johnson had been returned to the White House in a landslide of public approval, Moynihan decided to write an internal government document on the Negro family, one that might provide a policy alternative to the growing and increasingly unfocused demands of the civil rights establishment. Moynihan felt that anti-segregation bills, no matter how effective they were in assuring the moral high ground and funding for the civil rights movement, were not an adequate way to get at the heart of the problem. Quote, "I woke up a couple nights later," Moynihan recounted, describing the aftermath of the Johnson landslide, "at 4 o'clock in the morning and felt I had to write a paper about the Negro family to explain to the fellows how there was a problem more difficult than they know, and also to explain some of the issues of unemployment and housing in terms that would be new enough and shocking enough that they would say, well, we can't let this sort of thing go on. We've got to do something about it." Says Jones, "The opportunity to do something was unique. A significant constellation of situations, both domestic and foreign, had created a major window of opportunity." According to Moynihan, in 1964, the nation had reached a moment that had never occurred before. It was a moment, Moynihan would later relate in a postmortem on the report and commentary, which combined a willingness to accept a considerable degree of social innovation with, quote, "genuine feeling for the problems of Negroes." Quote, "The world was at peace. The president had enormous majorities in Congress. The success of the new economics was by then manifest. The Bureau of the Budget was already forecasting a $45 billion increase in the level of federal revenues by 1970, that is, from JFK's tax cut, actually, believe it or not. No demonstrators were abroad. No confrontation between white power and black protest was building up anywhere. In this atmosphere of maximum reasonableness and calm, an atmosphere in which the president could, without great risk, do nothing, and which for that reason provided an opportunity for history to be made, the president, seizing the opportunity, set in motion a major initiative." So this is when they embark on the great welfare state that hugely expands what FDR had started, and today we're trillions and trillions in debt. The initiative was based on Moynihan's research that fall. From December 1964 through March 1965, Moynihan and his staff put together the document that would eventually bear his name. During the course of the research and planning involved in creating the document, Moynihan shared his ideas with Press Secretary Bill Moyers, yeah, the leftist on public TV, who relayed enthusiastic comments from the president. Encouraged by the initial reaction, Moynihan eventually came up with a thesis that would challenge some fundamental assumptions about American political life. One of the most significant challenges was to the notion of American individualism. In the place of the dyadic structure of government and individual, Moynihan was proposing the intermediary structure of the family as the prime criterion of social health among the Negro and the prime locus of government activity in raising them to economic parity with whites, a goal that shouldn't be a goal. The thesis at the center of the Moynihan report had to do with family policy. Quote, "At the heart of the deterioration of the fabric of Negro society is the deterioration of the Negro family." And remember that all black social indices were rising as of 1960. They were getting better when the welfare state began. And then after that, they got rapidly worse. The Moynihan Report proposed economic help for the heads of black families. Family health, specifically increasing intactness and decreasing illegitimacy, was to become the government's criterion of social improvement, rather than now when they pay single women. What you subsidize, you get more of. What you tax, you get less of. That's a valid conservative principle. So if you subsidize people engaged in socially destructive behavior like single mothers, you're going to get more of it because you're paying for it. You're rewarding it with money. So the Moynihan Report, by contrast, urged aiding families, not single women. Family health, specifically increasing intactness and decreasing illegitimacy, was to become the government's criteria of social improvement. So that's what you would actually do if you're trying to improve things, or actually what you would do is nothing at all. Because if you don't subsidize these destructive things, that's enough to ensure that about the best happens. And the blacks who can't take care of themselves can be taken care of by the rest of those who want to support them, rather than have it forced on the general taxpayer. In February 1965, Moynihan told a conference on poverty that, quote, "The question of poverty is leading us to a major reassessment of the effect upon family structure of the way we do things in this country." Initial reaction was positive. The president was reported as saying, "Pat, I think you've got it." In March of 65, 100 copies were printed. Johnson had decided to make the ideas in the Moynihan Report, specifically the key claim that Negro poverty was related to, quote, the deterioration of the Negro family, the cornerstone of his new civil rights policy. The period of legislation, it was thought, was over. Race relations were to enter a new stage. In less than a year, a revolutionary change had taken place in social policy in the Johnson administration. Racial issues were subsumed into the larger question of poverty, and the family became the criterion for social health and the basis for social programs. A family policy was commonplace among European nations, but it had never existed in any coherent fashion in this country before. Now it was to be inaugurated as a way of solving the race problem that had plagued the country for the past 100 years. In early June 1965, Johnson presented his new program to the civil rights establishment in the form of a speech at Howard University, the traditionally Negro university in Washington, D.C. Before giving his speech, Johnson had it cleared with the major civil rights leaders in the land. The reaction was overwhelmingly positive. According to Yancey and Rainwater, Martin Luther King, Roy Wilkins, and Whitney Young, quote, expressed their enthusiasm and anticipated other civil rights leaders' pleasant surprise on hearing the speech. Robert Carter, general counsel for the NAACP, called it, quote, an amazing comprehension of the debilitation that results from slum living. The family, Lyndon Johnson told the assembled civil rights leaders in launching his new initiative, quote, is the cornerstone of our society. More than any other force, it shapes the attitudes, the hopes, the ambitions, and the values of the child. When the family collapses, it is the children that are usually damaged. When it happens on a massive scale, the community itself is crippled. So unless we work together to strengthen the family, to create conditions under which most parents will stay together, all the rest, schools and playgrounds, public assistance and private concern, will never be enough to cut completely the circle of despair and deprivation. In retrospect, it seems clear that Johnson looked on the family as a motherhood issue at just the time when motherhood and the family were on their way to becoming the most divisive issues in the nation. It seems just as clear that neither Johnson nor the Negro leadership were aware of at this time. If the Johnson administration had been looking for a revolution in American social policy, they could have chosen no paradigm so revolutionary as defining the family as the criterion for social health. Moynihan was correct in seeing the U.S. as virtually alone among the civilized nations in having no family policy, yet in proposing family as the criterion of social policy, no one seems to have anticipated the antipathy of the forces that were behind the civil rights movement, or to what extent that movement had become a pawn of the left, which means Jews. Moynihan saw it with hindsight in the postmortem he published in Commentary. For the first half of the 60s, he wrote, quote, the liberal left, for the most part, white, of course he's not going to say they're Jews, was very nearly dominated the civil rights movement. Most conspicuously, of course, in SNCC and CORE, but also in older line organizations. So whites dominated SNCC and CORE, but these whites were probably Jews. He's not saying that, though. The relation was not unlike that of the Marxist left to the trade unions of the 1930s. The mass of the movement in each instance was made up of rank-and-file persons with, on the whole, quite conventional views and expectations. But surrounding the leaders was an echelon of intense, purposeful, powerful, and dedicated persons of quite a different character. Can you guess who those might be? And behind them was a community of sorts, in universities, in churches, in large cities, small businesses, and assorted journalistic enterprises that provided funds, ideas, support, followings. All those things that make for effective political action. There is no need to exaggerate its coherence in order to perceive that something like a community of opinion has existed here. Direct quote from Moynihan, reassessing all this in the commentary later on. Moynihan does not deny the strife in such a community, but claims nonetheless that this coalition could achieve, quote, substantial accord, unquote, on issues that mattered to it. As it would turn out, the family meant a great deal to those people, but not in the way that Lyndon Johnson anticipated. Although no one seemed to notice it at the time, support for the family meant curtailment of the sexual revolution, which was just then spreading across the nation with the help of the foundations and universities and journalistic enterprises. In short, the community of sorts Moynihan failed to notice at the time. So there's a community that has an interest in the opposite of what he's promoting for blacks, which would be good. Moynihan in particular, and the Johnson administration in general, failed to see the connection between the left-dominated civil rights movement and the commitment to sexual liberation and eugenics, which had always been close to the heart of the eugenic foundations that were funding the civil rights movement. So yeah, I would argue that Jones here is significantly underrating the Jewish aspect, and his determination to destroy whites is what ultimately lies behind this. They destroy blacks, but the same policies also destroy whites, just at a slower rate. In terms of the personalities driving the civil rights movement, it was Sanger and Rockefeller all over again, with latter-day Claude McKay's and Max Eastman's thrown in as well. In 1967, Moynihan could still refer in a naive way to the left as the nation's secular conscience, without seeing how that conscience was burdened by sins against sexual morality, and how that sort of conscience was particularly sensitive to government initiatives which sought to foster family stability. As Michael Harrington, a key player in the link-up between the left and the civil rights movement, said, this was not at all a sour-faced, pietistic endeavor. Everybody was out getting laid. Flipping on to 424. This blindness vis-a-vis the left's secular conscience was a fortiori the case in 1965. No one in the Johnson administration was prepared for the change of opinion, which took place over the summer. Since the administration wasn't prepared, it could mount no defense against the force of opinion among the civil rights elite as it turned against its new family policy. The conventional explanation of why prevailing liberal opinion changed usually had to do with the escalation of the war in Vietnam. The same liberal constituency that ran the civil rights movement was becoming increasingly disenchanted with Johnson's foreign policy and began using the civil rights movement as a platform from which they could denounce the war. The riot at Watts is also sometimes offered as an explanation, but that in itself is one of the main things that still needs to be explained. The civil rights movement was faced with an increasingly paradoxical situation. The more legislative victories they achieved, the more restive the rank-and-file Negro became in northern cities. Some began to feel that the civil rights movement was raising expectations that it could not fulfill. In the end, Martin Luther King was unable to contain the violence his final march had spawned in Memphis. The uprising in the northern ghetto was proving to be particularly destructive counterimage to the saintly, nonviolent Negro set upon by police dogs in the South. In the summer of 1965, when the Watts riots followed the passage of that year's landmark civil rights bill by a matter of days, it was becoming increasingly clear that no one had a convincing explanation of why black violence followed so closely on the heels of such legislative victories. Perhaps it was in just this spirit of perplexity that Press Secretary Bill Moyers gave a copy of the Moynihan Report to Washington columnist Evans and Novak, who I actually worked for many years afterwards. Or maybe Moyers gave Evans and Novak the Moynihan Report because he felt that the rioting in the cities in the North could best be explained by family pathology. At any rate, once their column describing it appeared, the scrutiny increased, and as that happened, the left increasingly made it known that they did not like what they saw. Yancey and Rainwater, in their analysis, lead the reader to believe that the heart of the issue was a public relations problem. The chief difficulty lay in the fact that the Moynihan Report was a document written originally for a small group of government officials and then publicized by journalists who wanted to achieve maximal punch for their articles by emphasizing the most inflammatory aspects of the report. Yancey and Rainwater feel that the Evans and Novak article, which appeared on August 18, 1965, with lurid quotes like, quote, exposes the ugly truth about the big city Negro's plight, was, quote, the most influential news story connecting the report. They also feel that it was the most damaging. It did the most damage by diverting the public's attention away from the report's proposal on unemployment to a criticism of, quote, the breakdown of the Negro family. The implication is that a more successful public relations job might have saved this initiative. The verdict is based on the perception that the real nature of the proposal was misunderstood, whereas a reading of the opposition shows that the opposite may have been true. The opposition mounted because the critics understood only too well the message of the report and the fact that it was based on sources the left found uncongenial. In this regard, the critics of the report were more perceptive than its defenders. Yancey and Rainwater try to place the blame on the welfare establishment and their desire for increased budgets. However, a look at the forces opposing the Moynihan Report leads one to believe that opposition was wider and deeper than that. More was at stake here than the ability to increase one's departmental budget. The more one reads the sources of the document, the more one is impressed with hindsight at how antithetical they were to the values which pervaded the civil rights movement and its liberal supporters. One major source for the report, one conveniently overlooked when the charges were made that Moynihan was a white racist, was the writing of E. Franklin Frazier, the Negro sociologist from Howard University and classmate of Langston Hughes and Thurgood Marshall. Frazier claims that large segments of Negro family life were fatally weakened by a succession of slavery, Reconstruction, and the rootless life of the urban North. Frazier in many ways looked upon the last manifestation as the most devastating, but the common consequence of all these historical forces was a weakened family and, the point that Yancey and Rainwater tried to minimize, moral turpitude. Frazier does not downplay the effects of slavery, segregation, and racism. However, he makes it clear that the pathology which got its start under those conditions is not likely to disappear as soon as those conditions go out of existence. The pathology may have come about under those systems, but it has taken on a life of its own. Well, go back to Africa. How are they living there? Better? Not really. But again, Jones wouldn't admit there's any inherent racial problem here. In his study, The Negro Family in the United States, Frazier claimed that in the new environment, i.e. the slave states of the South, the Negro's sexual impulses were liberated from group control and became subject only to the external control of the master and the wishes and attitudes of those with whom he formed unions. When the sexual impulses of the males were no longer controlled by African customs and mores, they became subject only to the periodic urge of sexual hunger. In many ways, Frazier seems to prefer slavery to the period immediately following because of the stability of the social order and the ties between slave and master. Quote, when the yoke of slavery was lifted, the drifting masses were left without any restraint upon their vagrant impulses and wild desires. The old intimacy between master and slave, upon which the moral order under the slave regime had rested, was destroyed forever. Promiscuous sexual relations and constant changing of spouses became the rule, with the demoralized elements in the freed Negro population. The alternative to this social chaos was the traditional family, which owned income-producing property, often a farm, and which was under the authority of a father. This particular family constellation was congruent with Negro prosperity both during and after the fall of slavery and the Reconstruction period. Emancipation in this regard had little effect on Negro prosperity. Those who had stable families and acquired property under slavery did well then and under Reconstruction, in spite of the enormous handicaps they faced at both times. The, quote, well-organized family under the authority of the father, unquote, was able to make the transition from slavery to freedom in spite of the overwhelming odds against it. 100 years later, the country was to learn that those who lacked this starting point were unable to prosper or in many cases survive in the face of an overwhelming number of government programs and policy as much in its favor as the regime in the South had been to its detriment. Following the collapse of the slave regime, Frazier wrote, the families that had achieved a fair degree of organization during slavery made the transition without much disturbance to the routine of living. In these families, the authority of the father was firmly established, and the woman in the role of wife and mother fitted into the pattern of the patriarchal household. The father became the chief, if not the sole breadwinner. Frazier's view, it should be clear by now, goes counter to both the glorification of freedom, which lay at the heart of both the civil rights movement of the 60s, and the movement for the abolition of slavery of a century before. The Negro patriarchal family was the prime criterion of Negro prosperity. In the struggle to keep that family together, the comparative freedoms of the North, freedom, for example, from the moral restraints imposed by rural churches, proved more detrimental to the Negro than the system of slavery imposed by the whites. Much of black culture in this century, Frazier cites the blues and jazz as an example, is an expression of the inability to weather the challenges which freedom placed before the Negro. In many ways, the situation described in the North was worse than that of the South because in the northern city, this is a quote, He had not only escaped from the traditional subordination to white overlords, but had also cut himself loose from the moral support of relatives and neighbors. Family desertion has been one of the inevitable consequences of the urbanization of the Negro population. Frazier is in many ways true to the pastoral tradition, which condemns city life in general. However, in doing so, he misses the transvaluation of traditional values that was part and parcel of the culture of modern cities in America in the 20th century. Modernity put a premium on rebellion against God and escape from the moral norm, and as this philosophy spread through the instruments of culture, it began to permeate urban centers throughout the North. Indeed, the attraction of the city was seen specifically in terms of escape from the tyranny of Christian sexual morality in its Protestant redaction as enculturated in the rural South and small-town Midwest. The Negro was not immune to this sort of seduction. It is portrayed vividly in a work like Du Bois Hayward's Porgy, specifically in Sportin' Life's Seduction of Bess. In the Gershwin musical version, Porgy and Bess, Bess is told, "In Harlem we'll go struttin', and there ain't nothin' too good for you." Frazier's vision is consonant with the other sources of the Moynihan Report, namely Catholic social teaching. Quote, "As the result of family disorganization," Frazier wrote in 1950, "a large proportion of Negro children and youth have not undergone the socialization which only the family can provide." He then goes on to describe the dislocation in the black family in a way that is reminiscent of the writings of Pope Leo XIII. Quote, "The disorganized families have failed to provide for their emotional needs and have not provided the discipline and habits which are necessary for personality development. Since the widespread family disorganization among Negroes has resulted from the failure of the father to play the role in family life required by American society, the mitigation of this problem must await those changes in the Negro in American society which will enable the Negro father to play the role required of him." The role of the father, which found emphasis in Frazier, had special meaning for Moynihan as well, who had grown up in a broken family in Hell's Kitchen in New York City and had become a shoeshine boy at the age of 13. It was while working with other black shoeshine boys on the street corners that he first became aware of the similarities between the wild Irish slums of the late 19th century and the Negro ghettos of the mid to late 20th. Moynihan was raised without a father, but as a Catholic, he became cognizant of Catholic social teaching on the family. He mentions the writings of the Jesuit John Lafarge during the 30s. Lafarge was associated with Friendship House and the Baroness de Huck Doherty, the woman whose efforts in Harlem made such an impression on Thomas Merton. Moynihan's proposal grew out of Catholic initiatives like that, a fact soon noticed by his opponents in the culture wars of the 60s, which were in many ways the culmination of the eugenic anti-Catholic campaign which Blanchard publicized in the late 40s. Yancey and Rainwater are less specific, but make the connection more emphatically. Moynihan's views, they wrote, quote, "were strongly influenced by Catholic welfare philosophy, which has emphasized the idea that family interests are the central objective of social welfare and of social policy in general. He had observed that most European nations and Canada had adopted family allowance programs to cope with difficulties of income maintenance at low-income levels." The connections, says Jones, between the Moynihan Report and Catholic social teaching are neither abstruse nor difficult to find. Writing in Rerum Novarum, the encyclical which inaugurated the entire modern tradition of Catholic social teaching, Pope Leo XIII states that, quote, "the right of ownership, which we have shown to be bestowed on individual persons by nature, must be assigned to man in his capacity as head of the family." In the same paragraph, Pope Leo XIII goes on to say that, quote, "the family, like the state, is by the same token a society in the strictest sense of the term, and it is governed by its own proper authority, namely the father." In keeping with the hierarchical nature of Catholic social teaching, the authority of the father is subordinated to the authority of the moral law, which is just one manifestation of the will of God, the ultimate father. All of these various orders find their congruence in the common good of a well-ordered state. Quote, "it is vitally important to public, as well as to private welfare, that there be peace and good order. Likewise, that the whole regime of family life be directed according to the ordinances of God and the principles of nature, that religion be observed and cultivated, that sound morals flourish in public and private life, that justice be kept sacred, and that no one can be wronged with impunity by another, and that strong citizens grow up capable of supporting and, if necessary, of protecting the state." According to the principle of subsidiarity, that is, things that are handled at the right level, where it's appropriate, the state was free to intervene in the affairs of the family only if the family had failed in some radical way. One example of such massive failure was, quote, if the natural bonds of family life should be relaxed among the poor, the power and authority of the law, but of course within certain limits, manifestly ought to be employed. The Moynihan Report was proposing just this sort of intervention. Yet even in this instance, those government programs should have as their first and primary goal the reinstitution of the moral law. Quote, first and foremost, Christian morals must be reestablished, without which even the weapons of prudence, which are considered especially effective, will be of no avail to secure well-being. Anyone who was even remotely aware of Catholic social teaching could hardly be unaware that when the popes talked about strengthening the family, they were talking about the strengthening of the moral law. In Quadragesimo Anno, Pius XI claimed that all we have taught about reconstructing and perfecting the social order will be of no avail without a reform of conduct. If the discussion of Yancey and Rainwater proves anything, it shows that in many ways the left was more aware of this fact than Moynihan or his supporters, and they wanted no parts of any reform of conduct that infringed on the ever-burgeoning forces of sexual liberation. In addition to regretting the lack of better public relations, Yancey and Rainwater tried to distance themselves from the moral message that was at the heart of what Moynihan was proposing. In this instance, one has more sympathy for the liberal critics. At least they knew what was involved, and they fought against it in a way that was completely consistent with their ideology of personal freedom. Yancey and Rainwater, however, can only complain that, quote, in the public version of the report, it would have been well to reduce the discussion of illegitimacy because of the inflammatory nature of the issue with its inevitable overtones of immorality. Certainly in many of the newspaper accounts, a sensitive reader will note veiled accusations of immorality. In the aftermath of its failure, it became apparent that the Moynihan Report's defenders seemed embarrassed to the point of apology by the moral implications the report itself raised. Perhaps because it did not count as good sociology, there was a shyness in dealing with the moral underpinnings of the report. Instead of dealing with the issue directly by saying, in effect, yes, social reform is impossible without a reform of conduct. You know, these niggers got to act right, or none of this works. Yancey and Rainwater pretended that one could have a program which calls for strengthening family life without mentioning the moral underpinnings of family life, namely sexual morality. One has a right to expect, Yancey and Rainwater opine, that intelligent social observers will deal with the problem by taking it out of a Puritan moral-immoral dialogue and placing it in the context of social causes and social costs. So Jones is saying they're trying to make morals neutral what cannot be morals neutral, because it's at its heart, it's a moral problem. It's a problem of the moral order. How do you act? How is society? Society needs strong families, but that requires certain behavior on the parts of the different people, on the part of the mother and on the part of the father. And without that, you have purely a technical solution, which is what he says the WASP and the secular humanists and the modernists are always looking for, a secular, technical solution to what is essentially a moral problem. That's always Jones's point. But of course, this is precisely what the left was unwilling to do. Instead of dealing with the issue of sexual morality openly, the report's defenders could only seek refuge in their status as social scientists. In attempting to defuse the, quote, gut reaction of the left, the Johnson administration only exacerbated it by not dealing forthrightly with the root cause. Few social scientists, Yancey and Rainwater claim, would admit to a personal conscious view that having an illegitimate child is immoral. But the reactions of a great many social scientists to the use Moynihan made of illegitimacy data would suggest that they are struggling with such a view within themselves, which they project on the larger public. They seem to be saying, it's not that I think there's anything wrong with having an illegitimate child, it's just that conventional people do, and therefore we ought to talk more about this. The fears of the liberals went deeper than that. What Moynihan was proposing attacked the root of what they believed in, every bit as much as Catholic social teaching did. If social progress for the Negro meant proclaiming the necessity of personal morality, particularly in the sexual sphere, then that was a price too high to pay. The Negro could go back to his ghetto and stew in his own juices if racial justice meant something as radical as all that. In his own postmortem, Moynihan cites an article by Marcus Raskin in Ramparts attacking him and the notion that the government had any concern with the morality of its citizens. Likewise, Christopher Jenks traced the Moynihan Report to the conservative tradition where, quote, "the guiding assumption is that social pathology is caused less by basic defects in the social system than by defects in particular individuals and groups which prevent adjusting to the system. The prescription is therefore to change the deviants, not the system." Jenks, who was a fellow with the Institute of Policy Studies, and I got half my shit I read in college was from those guys, because I had a leftist WASP professor of the type he's been talking about through this book. Yeah, we read loads of IPS commie crap. And therefore, in a position to know, claim that, quote, "radicals have maintained that involvement in such issues, i.e. those concerning the family, is a first step toward 1984. See, the left wants to reserve morality for bashing anyone opposed to its program as some kind of morally evil creature, like a racist. This hostility seems to derive largely from a fear that the government will try to impose sexual continence and fidelity, virtues which almost all critics think greatly overrated." What the liberal left saw in the Moynihan Report was an attempt to roll back their hard-won sexual freedoms. This particular attempt to strengthen the Negro family proposed a sexual morality that they had deliberately jettisoned en route to becoming part of the sexually enlightened left. One of the main reasons they were interested in the Negro in the first place was because the Negro, or certain Negroes, exhibited such guilt-free, uninhibited sexual lives. The liberals were willing to choose the ghetto in 1965 because they had, in effect, been choosing the ghetto all along. Their interest in the Negro grew out of an interest in Negro jazz and all that that stood for in imagery fostered by whites interested in overturning the social order. The liberals had basically the same point of view toward the Negro as the Ku Klux Klan, but with the values completely inverted. For the liberal, the uninhibited lives of the lower class in touch with primitive, i.e. sexual nature, were superior to lives lived according to white, i.e. Christian, morals. Like the hero of Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road, the liberal walked the halls of Congress or the Ford Foundation, quote, "wishing I were a Negro, searching for spade kicks." The Negro provided an alternative gospel according to which family responsibility was to be eschewed in favor of ecstasy, joy, kicks, darkness, and music. Like the Ku Klux Klan, the left was ready to write the moral Negro out of the race as an irrelevant aside. The real Negro, the one the disaffected whites wanted most to emulate, was the pimp and the stud. Negritude meant sexual license without guilt. Freshly arrived in New York as a refugee from Nazi Germany, Paul Tillich, the liberal Protestant theologian, found himself in a similar situation. The mise-en-scene is related by his wife Hannah in a memoir that exposes the sexual roots of modernity with devastating clarity, so devastating, in fact, that Tillich's reputation as a theologian has yet to recover from the blow its publication dealt. Whenever they traveled or moved, the Tillichs were in the habit of first visiting the red-light districts of their new surroundings. Hannah found whorehouses a window into hidden truth. When they arrived in New York as refugees from Nazi Germany in the 30s, they were disappointed that New York didn't have a red-light district in the same way that, say, Amsterdam did, but then they found Harlem. "We found some sort of consolation in Harlem," she wrote, quote, long block quote here. "Somebody must have taken us to Small's Paradise, where one went up a steep staircase, watched by an old pockmarked Negro, whose muddy uniform with gold braid we feared a little. Later we would shake hands with him. Inside the dark, long room we sat facing clouds that drifted behind an orchestra of Negroes who played noisily and shrilly. It was as if we had entered a tropical forest with parrots screaming, dark faces peering out of the jungle, falsetto voices and brilliant colors. A Negro danced with me, a Negress with Paulus. We felt relaxed at Small's and returned there with our friends, grateful voyeurs, taking in the primeval charm of the hardy men and swaying women. We considered it an aesthetic show. We did not think at all in economic, political, or social terms. Once we dared to go to a show in a basement where there were mostly Negroes, in the dancing space at the center of the room, occasional performances were given. A a nude negress painted gold, having danced with a Negro twice her size, leaned her body against a post and masturbated with violent, snake-like movements, while her former partner and another girl unmistakably performed the acts of intimate sex. It did not seem vulgar or fleshy. It was filled with the natural vivacity of these beautiful black people. People at the seminary did not think our adventures were such a good idea. They had misgivings about our dancing with Negroes. Later, others objected to our aesthetic attitude concerning Negroes. Paulus and I had talked about the black image from primeval times on, the dark people being considered the least aristocratic. In psychic circumstances, the black or dark one always the devil. The black soul against the white soul, black as a magic color expressing evil or dark underground powers. So all these idiots basically see blacks as primitives who are closer to nature, closer to life. They have deeper souls and they're in touch with the evil powers as well. So they make kind of these clown figures out of them rather than just jungle monkeys they actually are, or children of God, as E. Michael Jones would have you believe. In the eyes of the modern elite, the Negro had become the instrument for overturning of Christian values. That most Negroes themselves were Christians meant little to people like the Tillichs, little in relation to what they could be made to symbolize. And as for actual Negroes, there were plenty who were willing to collaborate with the arbiters of modernity in return for financial and other gains. In the mid-20s, that alliance was known as the Harlem Renaissance. It was promoted chiefly by white decadents like Carl Van Vechten, whose novel Nigger Heaven found its climax in a young black writer attending a black mass. It was a touch which Hannah Tillich would have appreciated, but it offended the Negroes who were interested in the family life Van Vechten disdained. W.E.B. Du Bois and others complained that the only Negroes who got through to the white publishing world were those who pandered to the modern whites' cravings for decadence. In a memoir written after Tillich's death, Rollo May described the influence — he's one of those self-esteem psychologists — Rollo May described the influence Tillich had on his life as a result of meeting him in January of 1934 at Union Theological Seminary, which was not far from Harlem. "A wave of freedom swept over me," May said, describing Tillich's influence on his personal development. "Freedom from all the futile arguments of undergraduate days. Most of these foolish arguments had to do with the existence of God and his moral law." Quote, "I felt freed also from the nagging inner compulsion to believe," May continued, and then went on to describe some of the futile arguments which fell by the wayside under Tillich's tutelage. Quote, "Paulus's statement took away my security, that childish belief to which, against all intellectual development, I apparently still clung. I knew that God, for most people, was the guarantor of the status quo. He protected them from fundamental upset, from moral anarchy. God guarded the sanctity of marriage. He was against crime. He protected property, especially if you belonged to one of the sects that sprang from Calvinism. The word atheist conjured up all the opposite things. A satanic person who is anti-moral, who believes in free love, who is dishonest and would torture your grandmother, plus all the invective hurled at atheistic communism in our day. Infantile as were these vestigial remnants of my early imprinting, and outrageous to my reason as they still are, I cannot deny that they existed somewhere in my consciousness. It required not logic, but living and time to mature beyond such superstitions. It also required living and time to absorb what Paulus was trying to say." In place of all that, according to May, Tillich promoted the idea that the concept of God is continually changing. It is flexible, dynamic, always in process. The phrase, God above God, small g above big G, does express the eternal in a metaphor which does not crystallize into a dogma. Obligingly enough, God above God, quote-unquote, doesn't ask much of us, certainly not much in the realm of sexual restraint. In this regard, he is remarkably like Paul Tillich himself. And this was his prime attraction to moderns like May, who wanted belief without restraints. May gives the following account of one of Tillich's sermons. Quote, "Nothing is demanded of you, no idea of God and no goodness in yourselves, not your being religious, not your being Christian, not your being wise, and not your being moral. But what is demanded is only your being open and willing to accept what is given to you, the new being, the being of love and justice and truth, as it is manifest in him whose yoke is easy and whose burden is light." Quote, The meaning of this statement quoted above, May goes on to tell us, is that there is demanded of us no belief in a particular God, nor of being religious in a particular sense, nor being Christian, nor being moral, My faith and hope is that this new religious outlook will be characterized not only by internationalism, but by interracism and intersexism as well. He means mixing those. At Union Theological Seminary, liberal race relations were well on their way to replacing Christianity as the orthodoxy of the 40s and 50s. Tillich's influence is hard to minimize. Martin Luther King wrote his dissertation comparing Tillich and Henry Wieman, W-I-E-M-A-N-N. Tillich was still alive in the 60s, but more importantly, his influence had been institutionalized in institutions like the National Council of Churches, and it was precisely the National Council of Churches which led the opposition to the Moynihan Report. And that's where it ends, Chapter 10, Part 3 of Libido Dominandi. So we hear about the Moynihan Report, and right when they, at the very start of the gigantic metastasizing of the welfare state, there's someone actually care enough to say, here's the reality of it. You need to get these people acting right. And if you're going to aid anything, aid the family. Don't subsidize bad stuff, subsidize good stuff. And that is a correct principle and always will be. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and alexlinder.com. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll do Part 3, Chapter 11.